And he liked to wear his tweeds, and he spoke in a very standard English way. So I remember one of my December 12th movement youth responding to his saying how the Audubon was in such terrible condition that it couldn't possibly be saved and that it was a lost cause. This young man got up in his testimony in the community board and said, "You don't even talk black." So I could just see Max Bond, his humiliation after being assessed as not even talking black. So that was hilarious. Anyhow, but you know, one had such few joys because it was so frustrating, because what I learned, I'm talking to Sonny Carson one day, and he says, "Oh, well, do you really think that we could win this?" And I said, "Well, I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't think we could win this." Yes, yes. So one of the great things we did was we decided to have a sit-in at the Landmarks Preservation Commission. Was it Laurie Beckelman's first day? I think it was her first day. And one of our friends was Joan Shepherd, who was a reporter at the Daily News. So she had an exclusive to cover our sit-in. And she was mindful of her sources, and she wanted to be a player too, so she warned the Landmarks Commission that we were coming. But the fortunate thing is they didn't really believe her. So we went up, and we began our sit-in, and before the Daily News reporter could get any pictures, Laurie had already vacated the hearing room, but we had all of our young people held up these placards that had X on them for Malcolm X, and I don't remember what the others said, but we got some press. Well, then a miracle happened, a miracle of preservation, and I got to examine how costly it can be to be a preservationist, how costly it can be to be courageous and forthright and to do the right thing. And that miracle was Ruth Messenger, the borough president, and she determined that there was some arcane element of the law that said that if this city money was going to be used to destroy the Audubon, that the borough president of Manhattan had a final say on approving the money. So she said that she would withhold the money until some preservation component could be devised for the Audubon. And, oh my God, overnight, she was so roundly denounced by every editorial board in the city. Every one. And the really terrible thing was, you see, is because historic preservation was, and to some degree still is, something so obtuse for most African Americans, there weren't any great black leaders coming out in Ruth Messenger's defense saying, "Well, wait a minute, this is our history, this is our culture that you're trying to destroy." And also Columbia had been very clever in buying off everybody who you might have liked to come out denouncing their project. So they had given Malcolm X's widow some kind of appointment and sent her on some trip someplace or another. So she was all down with the project and said that, you know, that she had been told the building was beyond repair. And And Max Bond, he was getting the job to design the new building. So he was, anyhow, any one African American who you would have liked. And another person who'd already been co-opted was David Dinkins. David Dinkins. I remember I tried to ambush him at some meeting at the Hispanic Society in Harlem, and I said, "Can you help us with the Audubon?" And he said, "Help you?" He said, "They're going to make it a biotech research lab." I said, "But can you help us to preserve it?" I said, "It's an important African American landmark." And he said, "All the landmarks are important." I said, "But this one is particularly important for African American history." Anyhow, so that led to nothing. So Ruth Messenger, she really, it's astonishing. I think that was the beginning of her undoing, and how it is that David Dinkins treated her so shabbily when she easily, after his first term, could have run and beat him, but didn't. And then he got defeated by Giuliani. And then when she ran after Giuliani, his support of her was lukewarm at best. It was, oh, horrible, horrible. So she can't be praised highly enough for what she did. And what she did end up doing then was getting most of the facade preserved. Three quarters of the lobby preserved, and a few feet more than half of the room where Malcolm X was killed preserved. As well as there was some art, a wonderful statue of Malcolm X and a mural about his life in the room where he was killed, and these etched glass doorways that symbolically are supposed to refer to him. And initially, I was very dogmatic and outraged, and I was quoted in various papers saying that, this is a travesty, that it would be better for them to destroy everything than to save a few relic-like fragments of this building. I said, "You wouldn't take just the stage from Ford's Theater, or you wouldn't save just a part of the Dallas Book Depository or a portion of the Lorraine Motel. You would save it all." But of course, later, I had to admit my error and to say how there can be no better indictment of the people who destroyed the Audubon than for someone to come to the Audubon, see the beautiful terracotta facade, see the beautiful plasterwork in the lobby, the very plasterwork of which it was said that it was impossible for it to be saved, and then to go around to where the theater was, this enormous theater, and to see a parking lot. A parking lot that could be put any old where. Could have been put underground. A parking lot. The Audubon was destroyed for a parking lot. So that was a valuable lesson to realize that something is something versus nothing.
This experience inform you later when the Renaissance Ballroom was being fought over from all these sides?
Well, you would like to have thought that it would have helped inform me, but it didn't really, because the same difficulty that I had before persisted. I might show a photograph of myself out picketing in front of the Renaissance on Facebook and have, a dozen likes, and people say, "Oh, well done," or whatever. But the business of getting people to join you in protest, that's something else altogether different. And so it did inform me from the standpoint that in that case, I didn't even care if I got anybody else to join me. I just thought, okay, well, I'm going to picket at the Renaissance until they tear it down and try and get as much press, as much negative press for the Abyssinian Church as I can. So I did that and had some success, but you know, the building's gone. And then you know, there's this horrible abortive thing, like the guy who just became the new state senator for Harlem, Brian Benjamin. He was at that point the head of the land use committee of the community board 10. And so he and this other guy who I'd been working with, they engineered what they said was going to be a meeting of the developer and the community, and we were going to come up with this wonderful compromise. And it took a long time to realize that what they thought was an adequate compromise was to take some diamond-shaped bricks and put them in panels that were vaguely reminiscent of panels that had been on the Renaissance. But they weren't even the Hispano-Moresque or Mayalaka tiles that had been there. It was the most cynical kind of gesture, and yet they called this a reasonable compromise, and I just thought, oh golly, I've been hoodwinked again, wasting a lot of time pursuing something which is nothing. So that was bitter, you know, getting arrested for a long time. I was hopeful that I would be able to successfully sue the city.
For the arrest?
For the arrest, because from my perspective, all I was doing was expressing my First Amendment rights and going there and protesting. And I was arrested, held in jail for like, I don't know, what was it? 2.5 hours, three or four hours, something like that. And arrested, but not for doing anything illegal. And the thing that seemed to me to underscore all of that was the fact that that was in, when? I believe that was in late October, and I continued to picket there every Sunday until they demolished the Audubon. They demolished the Audubon on...
The Renaissance or the Audubon?
I'm sorry, the Renaissance. They demolished the Renaissance on the... I believe it was the Friday before Easter, on Good Friday. And I picketed on Easter and on the Sunday after Easter. And twice after my arrest that first time, the police did come and I chatted with them, but they went away. I was never arrested again. But I wasn't doing anything differently from what I had done that very first Sunday. So if it was wrong then and worthy of my being arrested, then I should have been arrested dozens of times again. But instead, of course, that initial arrest for disorderly conduct, they dismissed it. So then why was I not entitled to something? So that's pretty horrible. It's always a surprise to learn how the world you were taught to believe existed, the degree to which it doesn't exist. Now, that said, I'm not so cynical as to say, well, you know, fairness doesn't exist at all, and that good triumphing over evil doesn't exist. But to coin a phrase, as the president said, the system is rigged. The courts are predisposed to accept the lame explanation of authority, irrespective of the facts. And that's whether you've got a videotape of someone in a chokehold by the police who dies before your eyes, or if you are arrested for doing nothing other than expressing your First Amendment rights. It's rigged. And realizing that makes it easier to appreciate why it is so hard to motivate and interest and involve people who in other ways, whether it's their encounters with the school system or the police in other ways or government in other ways, why they are so disheartened and disillusioned and dispirited to a point where they feel like whatever it is that you are trying to do, that there's no point in doing it because the system's rigged. Many people came, many people passing me by, the thing that I would chant when I was at the Renaissance was "Save Harlem Now." And many people would say to me, as I chanted, they would say, "You're too late." And in a way, I find it hard to disagree with them. When you're talking about Black Harlem, when you're talking about buildings that represent Harlem's Black heritage in some unique way, be they churches or former nightclubs and former bars, those are being swept away at such a startling rate. There's not a church in Harlem that's safe from becoming a luxury condo with that has a little obscure place in the corner for the church. And the odd thing about that is that the reality of the economics of America, the disparate wealth of whites versus blacks, means that in a neighborhood with a median income of $37,000, these new buildings with $3,000 a month studio apartments are going to primarily go to white people, and that those churches are simply escalating the rapidity with which blacks will be displaced and overwhelmed by whites living at market rate in buildings that they can't afford to live in. And you can easily appreciate that being offered several million dollars and a new place to worship, that these dying tiny elderly congregations would imagine that this is the hand of God interceding on their behalf, and that they are going to be able to use this opportunity to race back to life. But no, they're just prolonging the inevitable and destroying the building that manifests who they are in the process. And so that when they go, they'll go without a trace that they were ever even here, because that church space is destined to become, I don't know, a community room or an art gallery or something, and they'll be gone. They'll be gone. And that's why all of this frenzy around developers calling Harlem south of 125th Street Soha doesn't bother me at all, because it's only symptomatic of something far worse, which is the gentrification that is displacing black people in Harlem. And I used to, you know, think because of all of this indoctrination of what it is to be an American, I used to think that that it was, you know, wrong to expect that Harlem should remain a largely black community. But then, of course, I realized that all of the efforts to make Harlem into a largely white community have not happened in some organic, accidental, spontaneous way. That these have been conscious efforts and stratagems of city government working with commercial interest, that neither the commercial interests nor the city government are especially antagonistic towards black people, but they're simply aware of the reality that black people have less money. And what they want is to make the most money possible, not a living wage or anything, just the most money possible. One of the funny things that happened, you know, after 2008 is that before 2008, there'd been all of this feverish real estate speculation in Harlem. So there were all sorts of new condominium buildings built. And when the crash occurred in 2008, the city council had this great idea. So many of these condominium buildings in Harlem and other neighborhoods were incomplete and completely empty. So they thought, well, let's go to the owners and buy them and make them into affordable housing, for which there's this tremendous demand. And before they could even organize such a scheme, they were just turned down left and right, because the owners of those properties did not want to just recover whatever they had invested or some modest profit. They wanted to make the most that they could possibly make. So that is what historic preservation is up against in America. And what's really daunting for me is that so often people who call themselves preservationists today across the country, they just seem like they're developers of nostalgia or something or other. The woman who's the head of the National Trust, she's got this bizarre notion that she has publicized far and wide that the number of house museums in America is unsustainable, and moreover, new house museums, the notion of new house museums in America is completely a completely faulty one.
I'd like to illustrate some of these points with something specific. And I think if you provide the same context for the Renaissance project that you did for the Audubon Ballroom, that whole narrative leading up to how it got to that point where you were protesting the demolition before it took place, it will illustrate some of these points pretty specifically. So give me some background.
Well, I think I will. I'm getting there.
Sure.
So the reason why I bring up this woman at the National Trust is because of a house that's not in New York City, but that's in New York State, the Villa Loire at Irvington, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a house that was built by Madam C.J. Walker as her country house and 4 little acres at Irvington. And she had initially wanted to remodel a house in Flushing, Queens, a house called Bishop's Court, and had negotiated with the estate of the Methodist bishop who owned that property. He had died. And her architect, Vertner Woodson Tandy, the second licensed black architect in the state of New York, he designed a scheme for a house there for her. But her white neighbors, her prospective white neighbors, they thought that it had been all right to have an African-American bishop as their neighbor, but this woman who was born the daughter of slaves and who was a scrub woman at the start of her career, they just couldn't see it. So when she decided to buy these 4 acres in Irvington, she took the precaution of having a white lawyer buy the property on her behalf, and she built her house. And when she died, her daughter inherited it, and when her daughter died, it was sold to this fraternal organization called the Friends of the Forest. In the meantime, the house that Madam Walker had built in Harlem on 136th Street, where her architect had taken 2 small conventional brownstone-fronted houses and combine them behind a neo-Georgian facade modeled directly after the Percy Pine house at Park Avenue and 68th Street, is that the cross street? I think it is. That house became a city health clinic, and then in the late 30s was acquired by the New York Public Library and demolished and replaced by a sort of international style library building. Well, I have this fantasy because, unlike so many of today's preservationists who think that replication of historic buildings is of no value and that it's actually detrimental, I point to the rebuilding of the Campanile at San Marco in Venice, and the replication of the cathedral in Dresden, and a host of other examples, to say that no, that to restore something that was, that had great value and meaning to people, that can be really quite impactful and positive, and that to keep that building, the public library, but to replicate the facade of Madam Walker's house there, that would be so neat for our kids, I think, to go to the library. Anyhow, so that's my fantasy for 136th Street, but for Madam Walker's house in Irvington, its problem is that as a house in America created for an African American in a white world and perhaps in one of the richest community of some of the richest whites in America, that compared to the Rockefeller estate Kaikit, or compared to John Gould's estate, not Jay Gould's estate, Lyndhurst, or to the Astor estate, Ferncliff, that it's comparatively modest, but as I know from taking tours sponsored by the Cooper Hewitt Museum there, for African Americans who realized that when it was completed in 1917, that the average wage for a black New Yorker was $800 a year, and that that in all of New York in 1940, there were only, in all of New York City, all five boroughs, there were just under 400 people owned the place where they lived. For African Americans, that house is as unlikely as if it were Versailles. But the beauty of making it a house museum is that even though it had custom-made Italian Renaissance-style furniture produced by the Berkeley and Gay Company in Grand Rapids, and that despite that, that everything there in terms of the white world is ordinary enough that it could easily be replicated and all put back together again, both with actual things that were there and things that are virtually identical to things that were there. And so then the National Trust, they say, well, there's no place for parking. Well, you could park at Lyndhurst and you could have a shuttle bus that would bring people to Villa Loro. On and on and on. Anyhow, and they say, you know, well, house museums are unsustainable. This is not just any old house museum. This is not just any old house. This is a unique house in all of America. A black woman who just missed being born a slave by 2 years, whose parents were slaves, who was married and widowed by the time she was, with a child by the time she was in her early 20s, and who was exhausted from working as a washerwoman by the end of her 20s, she became the first African-American woman who was a self-made millionaire. Just for an African-American, I mean, that's the thing that, all, when I look at Harlem all the time, it's just the thing I marvel at. You know, here you've got this place where, at its peak in the mid-40s, probably you had around 500,000 people living there. The largest African-American settlement in the world. And so many, many people who were brilliant and talented beyond belief, people who, whose parents or whose grandparents were slaves, who themselves had had the experiences working as sharecroppers in some cotton patch, who went from the cotton field to Yale or Harvard or Columbia and became doctors and lawyers and artists. I mean, it's just, it's a miracle. And it is a miracle which should be especially celebrated by all Americans, because not only is it the redemptive answer to the evil of slavery out of which this country was born and flourished, but it is the redemptive promise that that can be done away with, and that the people who were slaves could can become anything. And that, of course, is the thing that makes one so frustrated and cross with oppression and with racism and with white supremacy, is that, you know, when you look at the improbability of the greatest tennis player in America being an African American, or the greatest golfer in America being an African American. You say, well, without oppression, it could be that the person who will cure cancer, they're just waiting for an opportunity to learn enough to cure cancer. How can we throw away such potential in our country? So that's just kills one all the time. And the worst sort of racism that exists today is the racism in which one is not just ignored, but dismissed. So that is how it is that you happen to have a place called Harlem where only 3.6% of the buildings are protected by landmarking versus 2/3 of the buildings in Greenwich Village versus about half of the buildings in on the Upper West Side. And the Landmarks Preservation Commission, you know, they have these rules and they have this funding and small staff and commissioners who are not paid, that their rules that identify that they will designate X number of individual buildings in a given year and X number of historic districts in a given year guarantee that a Harlem will never be able to catch up with a Park Slope or a Greenwich Village. How? So that's just out and out racism. You can't call it anything else. How can the city sanction such a disparity?
I'd love to add, when you were talking about the house, the first self-made millionaire black woman, there's a highly suspect timing. And now that we have all the colonial Williamsburgs we could possibly handle now, there are too many house museums.
Oh, well, you see, this I encountered this. In the mid-90s, I went to the National Trust annual convention. And their theme that year was cultural diversity. And to prove that they were culturally diverse, they established a scholarship program. And who were the beneficiaries? Well, all these black people who were involved with David Patterson's Save Harlem, which never accomplished a single thing in Harlem, except they did put up a couple of signs explaining some historic districts. But other than that, they never accomplished anything. Anyhow, their membership, almost en masse, seemed to come down to Miami Beach, where this cultural diversity themed National Trust Convention was being held. Now, I have to say, it was extraordinary. They did have wonderful workshops with incredible people saying all kinds of marvelous stuff about black history, which I'd never heard of before. But the tragedy was that there weren't very many people at those workshops, and the people who were there were all black people. Then they were holding their cultural diversity themed National Trust meeting in Miami Beach, where the NAACP had instituted a boycott because the mayor of Miami Beach had not received Nelson Mandela when he'd come to visit after apartheid was over. And then they decided that the opening night of this cultural diversity themed National Trust meeting would be on Yom Kippur, I think it was. That's just a thing. So anyhow, they had their newly selected director in the form of Richard Moe. So I go up to Mr. Moe and I say, Mr. Moe, because, as it turned out, the Villa Loire at that time was for sale. And so I go up to Mr. Moe and I said, Mr. Moe, the Villa Loire, Madam C.J. Walker's country house at Irvington, New York, is for sale. Could not the trust buy it and keep it safe until a suitable buyer could be found, the same way you did with the Octagon House nearby? So Mr. Moe very sanctimoniously says back to me, he says, "Well, I intend during my tenure to take the trust out of the business of simply being interested in the heritage and culture of the rich." So I said back to Mr. Moe, I said, "Well, Mr. Moe, I think that's a wonderful idea of yours. I really do. But before you do that, could you not acquire at least one property that did not represent the heritage and culture of rich, white, Protestant men?" Then I found his wife, and I was chatting with his wife, and I was talking to her. I said, "Don't you think it would be a good idea if the trust could buy this house?" And she said, "Oh, yes, 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 yes." And then later he came to me and he said, "When you spoke to my wife, she didn't realize that you were a journalist and that you were planning to write something for New York Newsday, and so this was terribly underhanded, and we think that you shouldn't quote her." Anyhow, the story never did happen, and when I heard that Mo was retiring, I thought, "Oh, hallelujah! Now a person even worse than Mo. She doesn't even think that." And worse, she then went to my friend Alilia Bundles and told her this crap. And Alilia Bundles, the great-great-granddaughter of Madam Walker, she then buys this crap that the Villa Loire should become a conference center or a fitness center or something else that can be self-sustaining and generate an income. And I just say, "It's mad, it's nuts. You wouldn't ask that of Mount Vernon." I said, "And Mount Vernon has so then she said, "Well, Mount Vernon has an endowment of $60 million or whatever it is." I said, "You don't believe that if a national campaign were mounted to save this unique house, that we couldn't raise $60 million and more for the Villa? You don't believe that? Why don't you believe that? You don't think that Oprah Winfrey and all these people would be happy to help us to raise this money? You don't think the corporations wanting to get in good with black people would say, 'Oh, well, we've got the Villa Loire Nikes now, and you can buy them and help save the Villa Loire'?" I mean, oh, golly. So that has created a breach in my friendship with Alilia, but I was speaking to some woman who was a member of the National Trust, and I was telling her what had happened, and she and Alilia, I guess, have some connection through the National Archives. They're both on the board there, and she seemed to think that she could talk Alilia around. I don't know. You know, back 100 years ago, Madam C.J. Walker and others were successful in their effort to raise money to buy Frederick Douglass's house and to make that into a house museum. And you see, that's the value of history. If those damn people with so much less and with so many more obstacles could do that then, how can we dare to set limits for ourselves today of what we can do with something that is unique? It's the ultimate of what there is representing black people in America. That's it. So that's too bad.
You do have to bring it back to New York City.
Yes, so back in New York. Meanwhile, back in New York, one of the most perverse episodes of my preservation interest in New York was having been considered at the beginning of the Bloomberg administration as a potential member of the Landmarks Preservation Commission. I had tried to go to work for the Landmarks Commission when I first came here, was unsuccessful, then was called up at the height of my Audubon activities and told that there was a job waiting there for me. But I realized two things: that, you know, the old saying of black people, last hired, first fired. But then I also realized that in taking such a job, it would effectively silence me from being critical about the city's involvement with the destruction of the Ottomans. So I did not take up that offer or entertain that offer. But when I got this call saying that they wanted to interview me, that there was some guy, and that there was this group that wanted to interview me on behalf of Bloomberg, that the head of this group was some guy named Lyman, who had formerly been the head of the Lyman Commission that had something to do with Watergate, I think. I went to that meeting, and Mr. Lyman was not there. Instead, he was hooked in a telephone connection, and as the meeting progressed, he asked me, he said, "Well, Mr. Adams, I appreciate your interest in historic preservation, but what about those times when you, as a city commissioner, will be dealing with a project where the preservation outcome and where the preservation goals and outcome and the goals of economic development and jobs are in conflict?" I said, "Oh, well, Mr. Lyman, from my experience, there are very, very few instances where that's so." He said, "Oh, yes, I know that. I know that's true. But what about those when it is?" I said, "Oh." I said, "Well, before meeting with you this afternoon, I decided it might be a good idea for me to review the law. So I did that. When I was in the Historic Preservation Program at Columbia, we'd been made to examine the law and its components. And I said, and the thing that always struck me about the law was its flexibility. I love that part where it says, any improvement exhibiting special character and or architectural, historic, or cultural significance. I said, but you know, in reviewing the law before meeting with you, I did not see anything anywhere that talked about any considerations to do with jobs or economic development or anything other than preserving historic resources. And therefore, that would be what I would have to be guided by as a commissioner, would be the Landmarks Preservation Law." Well, I knew that was the wrong answer. But that was the only answer that one should give. So I didn't get on the Landmarks Preservation Commission. Actually, I think it probably had more to do with the fact that I hadn't filed my income taxes in a decade because I had not earned enough money to file any income taxes. So,
can I ask you about, you have done some work supporting Community Board 10 in lobbying the Landmarks Preservation Commission to save certain sites on an emergency basis, and also a little more recently, like a comprehensive.
Oh yeah, you know, the thing of it is, this was so funny, is that those buildings on an emergency basis, that was in part prompted by, I was profiled by Adam Gopnik for the New Yorker just before my Harlem book came out. And he and everyone, they were always bugging the hell out of me. They were saying, well, you know, why are you doing this alone? Why aren't you involving more people? So I went to the Community Board 10, and I took Adam with me, I think, a couple of times. And it just happened that the building that became the Empowerment Zone building, built by the Harlem Board of Trade, it was under threat. And the building where Chez Lucien restaurant is today, that had in it this marvelous bar, which was the oldest bar in continual use in Harlem, and is the subject of a photograph from 1920 by Otis Butler called Last Call, from 1920, that shows people standing around the space getting their last drink before the Volstead Act takes effect. And that place, you know, with its mahogany framed cabinets with cut glass panels and animal head trophies and photographs of boxers and of pinup girls from the 1930s and 40s and 20s. That was all there in the building which had been built, I mean, in a building which had also housed upstairs the Harlem branch of the American Communist Party. So that was under threat. And the Renaissance was under threat. And so I came up with this list of, I don't know, was it a dozen buildings? Or whatever the number, I came up with this number. It certainly wasn't more than a dozen buildings. And that was published in the Times, I think, that list of buildings. That I got the community board to vote on an these buildings should be designated on an emergency basis. And, you know, got in the paper and that was it. Nothing happened. And worse than nothing happening is that just a couple years later, the same community board went down en masse to the Landmarks Preservation Commission, taking with them former Mayor Dinkins, former Parks Commissioner Gordon Davis, then Borough President C. Virginia Fields, Scott Stringer, David Dinkins is the saddest one because his wedding ceremony, his wedding breakfast was held at the Renaissance. And they all went down to plead with the commission to decalendar the Renaissance. Because, as they said, their plan was to preserve it, but that landmarking would be too much of an impediment, and that one of the things they intended to do was to demolish the theater, but retain the theater facade and build a new building behind the theater portion. Well, I knew nothing about this, so I wasn't there. And the commission had the audacity to say, oh, no one testified against doing this, so we decalendered it. And but then, as fate would have it, there was a fire. So the theater burned up. So then it didn't really matter to me so much whether they saved the theater. And I learned that it had already been altered anyhow in the 70s when the Renaissance Theater had become the headquarters for the, what was it called, for the Gilpin Players and the New Lafayette Theater Project, because that was another lost battle, the Lafayette. This theater, which was a beautiful building that had become a church, and the church decided to jackhammer off the facade. And then after that, decided that one of the two pavilions that had been on either side of the theater, one of which they'd already demolished for a parking lot, that they were going to demolish the second pavilion, which had been the Connie Zen nightclub and then the Yabangi Club nightclub. They knocked that down. So anyhow, so because of the fire, because of the alteration of the 1970s of the theater, the idea that they would build something behind that didn't bother me. But they never fulfilled that promise. And the commission, in agreeing to decalendar it, should have at least gotten a commitment in writing for them to do what they said they were going to do. But they didn't.
Who convinced them that? Who convinced them that landmarking would be an impediment to saving the facade? Like, who rallied that group together and who changed the community?
Well, the thing of it is, you know, they must have had some experience. People who live in Harlem who deal with old buildings, they have had some experience of dealing with landmarking and the Landmarks Commission. What they've had very, very little experience with is utilizing the investment tax credit. I mean, it's shameful how little that's occurred in Harlem. And so that the instances in which it has can be counted, I believe, on the fingers of one hand. And two of those happen at the behest of one of the most politically powerful and connected people there was, Bill Lynch. The Harlem Kingmaker, he, on behalf of two not-for-profits, the Apollo Theater and the African-American League of the NBA. Now get this, not-for-profits that don't even pay taxes, he managed to syndicate their tax credit and sell it so that they could benefit from being landmarked. And then unfortunate unintended consequence that often occurs is that at the NBA building, which is best known today as being the place where the Red Rooster restaurant is located, and the NBA has sold it. The NBA building had started out being built as a deluxe grocery store called Park and Tilford that was throughout the city. And, you know, they were sort of like the Dean and DeLuca of their day. And it was a very nice neoclassical building, brick with these marble columns and piers on the first floor. Well, in the 1930s, that building was acquired by the United Mutual Life Insurance Company, this pioneering African-American life insurance company, which was the largest black-owned life insurance company in America when they were sold to some big firm in the 1970s. And United Mutual had hired this guy named John Lewis Wilson, who liked to call himself the first black graduate of the School of Architecture at Columbia. But that was not entirely so. What happened was that there'd been a couple of African Americans who had enrolled in the School of Architecture at Columbia and who dropped out and never finished. And then Wilson enrolled. But before he could finish, he had to withdraw to go to work to make enough money to complete his studies at Columbia. And in the interim, this guy from Washington named Hilliard Robinson came to Columbia, enrolled, and finished before Wilson had a chance to. So for like the next 50 years, these two took turns fighting, saying that they each were the first black graduate of the School of Architecture at Columbia. But by the time I met Wilson, he said, and you know, he's like 92 or 91 or whatever. He said, but he's dead, so I'm the first black graduate now. So, this work that he had done streamlining the building in the 1930s, including taking those Ionic columns and piers and encasing them in brick so that the building didn't seem like this old-fashioned neoclassical building, the State Historic Preservation Office, not knowing that that had been done in the 1930s and by a black architect, they then okayed it all being undone, which they never would have done if they'd have known that John Lewis Wilson had done this. And so there's not a building left in Harlem that is an example of the work of John Lewis Wilson. Anyhow, so much for being the first black graduate of the School of Architecture at Columbia. What does survive that he designed is that he was working for the Parks Department in the 30s, and in this park in like 96th Street or somewhere around there, he designed this playhouse or comfort station, combination comfort station playhouse thing, and it's got this Art Deco railing with these scrolls, and the scrolls form these stylized monkeys. And one of the few sort of erroneous things in the magnificent biography of Robert Moses, The Power Brokers, is meant to be an indictment of Moses and an indication of his racism, that he had this PlayStation in Harlem with these monkey railings, because that's what Moses supposedly thought of black people. But in point of fact, it wasn't in a black neighborhood, it was at 96th Street. And you see, when Wilson was showing me his drawings, he had a drawing for this. He was very proud of this railing. He thought it was elegant and sophisticated, so did I. And because he said to me that he worked for the Parks Department and worked in Central Park, I thought he had said to me that that had been designed for the Central Park Zoo. So I went to the Central Park Zoo looking for it, and I couldn't find it. So it was just by chance that I'm looking on Facebook, and there is a picture of it. And there, someone below the picture has put this quote from the Power Broker saying this thing about the racism of Robert Moses. And I say, but 96th Street is not Harlem. And I said, the black children who would have seen that in the 1930s would have been few and far between. Mm-hmm. And moreover, this was designed by a black man. So, anyhow, the great thing is that I found out where this was, because I thought, I'd begun to think that it had never been built. But he assured me that it had been built. So, but I bet that's not landmarked either. So anyhow, the commission and their regard of Harlem has been just awful. Many African-American political figures and leaders, like many white leaders all over the country, have long held this erroneous notion that historic preservation is diametrically opposed to economic development and jobs. And why is that? Because, as I so often say to you, I say, well, in New York or in Paris or in Washington, look at all the places that have the most economic development, and you will find that, by and large, they're the places that have the most preservation. So how do you... And conversely, Harlem has virtually no historic preservation and has virtually no economic development. So how do you correlate these two things? How? Where do you come up with this correlation? It's just nutty. So, be that as it may, that notion is still, it's so entrenched. It's so dearly held by people. Now, you realize that without them even thinking about it or expressing it to themselves or expressing it out loud, that probably what people are really thinking is that their opportunities to share the wealth and let contracts with their friends who don't know anything about historic preservation and don't deal with preservation components to projects. I just say they should get some new friends. instead of penalizing us, they should just get some new friends. Well, anyhow, being aware that that was the attitude of politicians, that that was the attitude of black business people, that that was the attitude of black churches, you know, who have met and they've said in the past in their various meetings, there are these different groups made up of black churches, they've said, you know, we aren't going to allow those godless atheistic Jews at downtown dictate to us what we can do with our churches. So all of that taken together, the commission, you know, they're very wary of doing anything in Harlem. And because they don't want to get beat up on. But to me, that's just dereliction of duty. I don't care. You know, they got beat up on by the theater owners, and yet they designated the theaters. And and the combination of more white residents and of who have a greater predisposition towards the acceptance and acknowledgement of the value of historic preservation, and the increased loss where someplace so universally exemplary of everything that a landmark is, like the Lenox Lounge, both in terms of its distinctive style, as well as its history and associations with people. To see that destroyed has caused more and more people to become aware of the value of preservation. Now, how does this group that I helped to form, Save Harlem Now, how do they reach out and get those people to meetings and part of a membership that can be harnessed to oppose yet more destruction? I don't know. But I think that opportunity is ripe now because people are more frustrated with what they see happening there. Mm-hmm. So, but the commission, as I say, they continue to be terrible. The preservation groups less so. I think that it can rightfully be said that had it not been for the Historic Districts Council, that the Addisley Park Historic District in St. Albans, Queens, which sort of became a suburban Sugar Hill after the Second World War, or the small and inadequate, but nonetheless improbable, Grand Concourse Historic District, neither of those would exist. Nor, for that matter, probably would the extension of the Mount Morris Park Historic District. And therein leads one to another indictment of the commission, you know. When the Mount Morris Park Historic District was designated back in the early 70s, although people in the community were mostly concerned with brownstone row houses and not so concerned with apartment buildings, and although the people who were the most passionately concerned lived on or near Mount Morris Park West, they nevertheless were aware enough that they asked that the entire perimeter of the park be designated, and that an area going all the way over to 7th Avenue be designated. And what the commission said to them, they said, oh, don't worry, this is just the beginning, we'll be back. And the commission was back. 44 years later, by which time untold loss had occurred. And so, of course, keeping that in mind, I kept saying, stressing, well, you know, if it takes 44 years for them to come back, that's going to be a disaster. We need to get more. And the community did ask for more, but yet again, what was sought is still so much smaller than what was sought. What was given was so much smaller than what was sought.
Okay.
And then, and this whole thing, you know, of race and class, it's so thorny. I mean, I worked for State Senator Bill Perkins, but I first became acquainted with him for 4.5 years, but I first became acquainted with him when he was the Harlem City Council member, and we forged a relationship, and that was largely thanks to my friend, Carolyn Cassidy Kent, who was the founder of the Landmarks Committee of Community Board 9. And Carolyn was educated at Sarah Lawrence in Columbia, and she had that wonderful classic patrician accent, like Jane Hathaway, Mr. Drysdale's secretary in the Beverly Hillbillies. Just, you know, you'd think she was straight out of casting for a Vassar professor of 1940. But the thing I loved about Carolyn, or one of the things I loved about Carolyn, is that that accent notwithstanding, that she never condescended to people or tried to talk down to people or tried to simplify things because she thought, well, they won't understand this. And she always was able to communicate what she was trying to convey to people. And unlike me, she was an idealist and always expected and fought for what was right. And she always believed in the process and thought that one should cross every T and dot every I so as not to have that used as an excuse for not getting what you were going after. So that all these things were valuable things for me to learn. But the frustrating part of her being one's ally was that lots of times being told to dot every I and cross every T, you were just being sent on a fool's errand to waste your time, or worse, to tie you out so you'd just go away. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I hate being involved in those fool's errands, and I try to avoid it when possible.
I hate to say it, but we have been at it for 2.5 hours. We should probably wrap up soon.
Oh, no.
Is there anything I should have asked you or that we need to get in our last 5 or 10 minutes?
Well, I just want to emphasize how, you know, Bill Perkins, he's been very good on historic preservation, but even he, you know, there are no perfect people. There's no perfection in life. But even he, you know, he's someone who was educated on scholarships through his mother's intervention at Collegiate and at Brown. And yet he wants to be a champion of the black everyman, and he definitely wants to avoid elitism or snobbery, and is indeed a kind of a reverse snob in terms of denouncing the black bourgeoisie, which definitely can be problematic. But the reality is that all of his protests to the contrary, at this point, there's no one more bourgeoisie than he and his family. And it's a kind of ludicrous argument he makes, so that he has said to me many times when we were talking about trying to help to preserve the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, he said, well, you know, to me, the best thing would be to take that building and to make it all into affordable housing. And I said, but that's not going to happen. And so it should be preserved as something beautiful to inspire everybody, anybody, because you don't know what person in Harlem will see that and will decide they want to be an architect or an architectural historian or whatever. And he said, well, we don't need more people like that. We need more affordable housing. And I said, yes, we need more affordable housing, but you are like Booker T. Washington saying that the most fit destiny for African Americans is to be field hands and laborers. Field hands and laborers have their place, but we need everything. We don't need just housing. Man doth not live by bread alone. We need everything. And he has often denounced me saying things like, well, you know, you just want to take things back the way they were when this was a white community, and you even want the white people back. I said, no, I don't want the white people back necessarily. I said, but I do believe that it was beautiful, it was clean, it was exceptional, and that people who live here now, they deserve that too. Why not? Why don't we deserve that too? And I guess I say this to say that I have done combat with everyone there is in terms of preservation, including colleagues, and the worst thing about these efforts is that apart from all of the loss, is how one gets worn down, and how easy it is that people with power and resources are able to manipulate and divide people who have a common cause and purpose. And that's the really demoralizing thing, is to see how there are instances where we could win if we were better united, but that We've not yet learned to set aside our superficial differences to work for the common good. So that when the City Council was Intro 775, what I thought was a powerful message against that law or that amendment of the Landmarks Law would be for someone in Greenwich Village or someone on the Upper East Side or someone on the Upper West Side to say, hey, look, we have got many of the buildings that we want protected in our communities. And we were able to do that using a law that didn't set up any artificial time limits, knowing what the politics are like out there in the world, that either for historic districts or for individual landmarks. And what you all are doing now is not going to hurt our communities so much as the ones that you represent, you Black and Brown council members, who somehow think that this is going to make it easier to landmark things in your neighborhood, when in point of fact, it's going to make it more difficult. And so what you are doing is taking a process which has been unduly discriminatory in the past and making it even more discriminatory now. How are you doing this? How do you justify doing this?
Can I ask you one last question?
Yeah.
I'm terribly sorry to wrap it up.
Okay.
And I've really appreciated your stories today. You must have piles of papers and research from all these years of doing this. What's your plan for preserving them? Where are they going to be archived?
I don't have any plan. Right now, they are overwhelming me, and I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm trying to just get them all in order in terms of living with all of this paper and debris. But I do have one last story I'd like to.
Okay, yes. You can do it in 5 minutes.
Okay, I'm
going to
try.
So sorry to rush you.
I'm going to try my very best to.
Okay, thank you.
When the Landmarks Law was 40 years old, this I think sums up the difficulty I've had in being a preservationist in New York. When the Landmarks Law was 40 years old, the Museum of the City of New York, where I had mounted two exhibitions, one called Save Harlem Lost and Found, based on my Harlem book, and one called Black Style Now, talking about the way that African-American popular culture influenced fashion. The Museum of the City of New York had a symposium celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Landmarks Law at the museum, and it was called something like Preserving New York the Next 40 Years, something like that. But of course, what I noticed right away was that of all the panels assembled, that there were virtually no Black or Brown people. That where there were Black people, the roles they had were inconsequential. So for instance, Mary Schmidt Campbell, who was just gone to become the head of Spelman, but who at that time was the head of the Tisch School of the Arts at NYU, her role was to introduce panelists on one of the panels. That was it. And this, to me, had a dire consequence because here we were so close to Harlem, and there was no mention being made of Harlem, and at that point, 10 years ago, work was, you know, going on at fever pitch to transform Harlem. And so finally I just couldn't take, and then worse than that, one had people like the historian Robert Jackson, who was there, saying things that I just thought were injurious to communities like Harlem and New York in general, and just weren't true. Like he was saying, you know, that the problem of New York housing was that We had all this rent regulation, and if we had no rent regulation, we would have an abundance of housing for that would be affordable for everyone. And I said, well, what about when we had no rent regulation? There was no abundance of housing for anyhow. Finally, I just got up and I said, this is wrong that you have no black people here in the audience or on the panels, and it's wrong. It's like we don't exist in the city. And so Susan Hinshaw Jones, the then director, she said, Michael, just be quiet. And I said, I will not be silenced by your elitism and white supremacy. So the next thing I heard was, security! And so I'm being dragged. So I thought, what am I going to do now? So then I remember Martin Luther King, and so I decided I'd just go limp. So I go limp. And the next thing I know, there's this young African-American security guard who is trying to pick me up like a baby, all 210 pounds. I thought, oh, this is messed up. So I'm trying to kick this guy off of me. And so then, until he finally says to me, he says, go ahead, kick me again, my black brother, so I can beat you to a pulp. I thought, oh, hell. But then I look and I see his boss, who is also African-American, who is also a security guard, who is older and bigger and wiser than he, and who I befriended during these exhibitions. So then I was able to, you know, to be all, to be in my bluff way to say, go ahead, my black brother, and beat me to a pulp at the behest of the white man. Well, anyhow, so I didn't get beaten up. But, okay, so I thought, okay, this is over. I won't have to deal with this again. They'll surely get the message. The 50th anniversary of the Landmarks Law comes along. The Museum Institute of New York is going to have a panel discussion at the American Medical Association across the street from them. And I look, and all of the participants are white people. All of them. I think, you know, there might have been some Asian person, but in America, those Asians are honorary white people. So I then called Susan Hinshaw Jones's office, and I said, may I please speak to Susan? And I said, oh, she's not here. And I said, well, tell her, I'm very concerned about this panel. And they said, okay. So then I called her again, she's not here. So then I called the deputy director, she's not here. So then I sent an email and I said, you don't have any people of color as a part of your symposium. And if you don't get some between now and tomorrow, I am going to send out a press release and announce that I'm going to be picking your symposium. So Bob Stern was on the panel like he was on the panel before. And so this friend of mine in his office sent me an email and he says, by now you probably know that Claudette, whatever her name is, from Brooklyn, that she's on one of the panels. Well, she was on the panels, and she wasn't especially articulate, but she was the best thing they had on the panels. Why? Because she's seated right next to the head of the New York Real Estate Board, who references this ridiculous, specious study that they've done that says, have you noticed how in historic districts, there tend to be the least amount of affordable housing in the city? And so I said, oh, have you noticed that the richest neighborhoods get the most historic preservation the earliest, and how before they were historic districts, they had no affordable housing either? So he says this, and so she is able to say, well, in the historic district that I'm a part of in Brooklyn, we just were able to use the investment tax credit, the federal investment tax credit, to renovate two buildings, which are 100% affordable housing, both of them. Now, you'd have thought that Susan Hinshaw Jones or somebody would have called or written me a note and thanked me, but no. And moreover, that day, when I arrived for the symposium, I was stopped by a police officer and a plainclothes police officer saying to me, "We understand that you don't have a ticket for tonight's event, so we won't be able to allow you to go in." And I said, "Really?" I said, "Well, Ewan Chen from the West Harlem Preservation Organization, she bought 4 tickets and said that I could use all of them." So anyhow, I got in, but I'm telling you, the arrogance and the dismissal of people of color in New York City, you know, the greatest, most liberal city in the nation, persist, and it should not, because I'm just trying to, it's like, in a nutshell, it's like the whole thing that people say created Donald John Trump. They say that working class whites felt alienated because their issues were not being addressed in favor of identity politics. And that just boggles my mind. Yeah. When you're talking about creating a $15 minimum wage, is that identity politics? Is that not for anybody who needs $15 an hour minimum wage? When you're talking about having free community college, is that identity politics? But even when you are talking about identity politics, what do black people, what do women, what do gay people want? We want what you have. We don't want more than you have, but we want a job, we want a good place to live. Everything that you want, we want. And should we not be entitled to that? And if we get it, will it not be more likely that you will have it too? But no, it's like there's an idea that if you have what we have, it will somehow be taken away from us in order for us to get it.
I'm so sorry. I have to end it there. Okay. I screwed up and scheduled a conference call for 4:15.
Oh, no. I'm sorry.
No, it's really not your fault. It's my fault. But I do have to stop now so I can call them back. Oh. But thank you so much for coming in.
You're
so
welcome.
Sorry to hurry you out at this time.
Oh, no.
Thank you for your stories. What we'll do next is we'll make a transcript of this whole thing.
Okay.
And we'll mail it to you.
Great.
So you'll have time to, if there were any dates that you misplaced or anything you want to correct,
I'll
do the transcript
good.
Before we put it online.
Great.
I really am sorry to hear you out.